Hello, everyone. My name is Jacob Manig. I'm the host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today, we have a very special guest, Rebecca Erickson. She has her master's degree and is currently a licensed associate marriage and family therapist. She is a motivated self-starter, and she is a highly driven self-employed owner of her private practice facility, which she provides in-home, individual, and couples therapy. Today we are going to learn many things about Rebecca regarding her journey through graduate school, the exact steps she took to become an owner of a private facility and private practice. I, for one, am very excited to have Rebecca on. We are all in for a special treat. Rebecca, thank you so much for being on my podcast. I really appreciate it.
Sure, absolutely.
So just to start off, what made you want to be a therapist like growing up? Was there a particular motivation or event that occurred? Or,
Well, actually, I kind of came late into my career. Mm-hmm. So my first career, I was a professional musician.
Oh, nice. I got to ask, what did you play?
Yeah, I played clarinet. So nice. I actually played klezmer clarinet, Jewish folk music.
Nice.
So I did that for my first career. And then I got my undergrad degree in music performance at University of Minnesota. And then when the band that I was playing in was sort of dwindling down, I was thinking to myself, what would I want to do other than playing music? And I have always just been a person who has drawn to me people who have problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And want me to solve their problems. And so I was like, well, maybe I'll go into psychology or counseling. So I consulted with a couple of professionals and decided to go get my master's. And so okay. It was kind of just like that, really. It wasn't like a huge, earth-shaking decision or anything like that.
But was there a part of you that was a little nervous? Like, okay, grad school, what's that going to be like? What's this career going to be like, et cetera?
A little bit. I guess I was just kind of a little apprehensive about going to grad school because it just, one would think that if their undergrad was difficult, the graduate program would be even more difficult. But I actually found my graduate program to be quite, I wouldn't say easy, but just not quite as stressful as my undergraduate program.
I had the same exact answer, 110%.
Yeah, so I was really pleasantly surprised, actually, when I went to grad school about how, pretty accessible and straightforward it was. And I was able to get through my classes with not too much stress.
Mm-hmm. Would you say, and this is just my experience, in undergrad, the reason I personally struggled is because I was taking like 4 or 5 classes at a time, and there are a lot more exams. Where in my experience in grad school, you would probably take like 2 classes and that'd be considered full time. So it wouldn't be super difficult, but the workload would be a lot.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember back because I graduated in 2015. So it was a while back, but I remember in grad school, it took about 2 or 3 classes a semester. And I feel like grad school classes were more like about discussion and like sharing ideas and having like interesting conversations with the professor and the other mm-hmm. students. And learning and like more like hands-on, whereas like undergrad was just definitely much more like, okay, here's like the assignment and you have to read this chapter in a book. Yep. And we had things like that in grad school as well, but it wasn't emphasized as much. It was more emphasis was put on class participation and just like engagement mm-hmm. with other students.
Beautifully said. I remember my first day at Adler graduate school, my teacher Doug, he's like, all right, everyone, we're in grad school now. The goal is to actually learn, So I was relieved right away, Well, and again, for the most part, again, the teachers did care if you were learning. And if you put in the effort, you should learn to an extent.
Right. Yeah, I do feel like the learning style was much more like independently driven. So like you could definitely go to grad school class and just like breeze through it and just kind of coast on through and survive by getting like a C or B, but you probably wouldn't retain very much.
Right.
But if you really like put a lot into it, then you would get so much more out of it. And it was really just driven by your choice.
Mm-hmm.
So
I gotta ask you something too. The one thing, again, I was a little intimidated too going into grad school and therapy because, again, it's that grad school. What is it gonna be like? What's the workload? And when I got like my early assignments, I would look at the chapters and the sections, like you must read 30, 40 pages a night, whatever. So that didn't help my nervousness. And I'll be honest with you, like I never finished full reading assignments. I mean, I did what I could to like learn, and I'd go on like videos, but again, we all learn differently.
So like for my assignments, I remember let's see here. I would take a book, like a textbook, and for the chapter or the chapters that I was assigned, I would look for keywords
Okay.
and just kind of like highlight keywords and then like highlight really important, like huge concepts. And then I would go through the chapter again and just read the keywords really quickly, almost as if to form a sentence. And then I would be able to form the concepts. And I'd be like, oh, okay, I get this concept pretty well. And then like later I would like discuss it in class, and then that would just bring it all together, tie it all together. And then by the time I took the exam, I would actually retain more because it was done in a way that was more like abstract, which is more my style. So that's just how I learned.
So, did you guys actually have a lot of exams in grad school?
Well, I know for sure there was like a midterm and a final exam for every class.
Okay.
And some classes we had little quizzes each week, but it wasn't like
Wow.
super exam heavy. I mean, if anything, it was more like paper heavy. So like, there may be like a paper each week plus like two large papers in the semester. So each week a paper and then two large papers and then like an exam. So
Okay.
that would be a pretty intensive class. So probably about as intense as
And
it
again, I
gets.
know for me too, my experience, again, it was heavy on D2L, PowerPoint presentations, lots of papers, lots of papers. But I might have had maybe two actual exams in my entire grad school career, and that was it, like multiple choice ones.
Oh
That's
wow.
it.
Oh
So
no.
I was lucky because I'm not a good test taker, so that actually really benefited me. And I will say one thing too, I still learn. You still learn by doing PowerPoint presentations and doing essays and papers. Like I learned a lot from that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think there's like many different ways of learning, and like some people are just more attuned to like the textbook style, where they just traditional kind of like rote memory type, or like just reading a chapter in a textbook and then taking an exam. That's some people's style, and the other people's style is just maybe more hands-on. Like they may like do more have a better understanding of the concepts by like learning a quick like rundown of the concepts and then applying them right away to like an interactive activity. So there's just many different ways that people learn.
So, and I got another question too. So in this mindset right now, right, you're going to grad school. Did you know right away you want to do like the LMFT track, or did you consider other mental health like professions?
Well, I actually start off as LPCC
Oh, nice.
track, and then like I realized along that time that I really wanted to work with children
Yeah.
and families. And so I went to the LMFT department,
Okay.
and they interviewed me for that. It was almost like having like a job interview. They interviewed
Yeah.
that program, and then I was accepted, and then I changed tracks, and then I was in the LMFT program.
Okay. I mean, it must have been like interesting because it's like they knew you were a student there and everything. You're just gonna switch paths, right?
It was just like the two different departments at St. Mary's. There was like
Okay.
LPCC and then LMFT, and they were like, oh, okay, so she's going to this different department then instead. So
I guess I know in Adler, the main difference is that, yeah, you t there's different classes too, but I think the LMFT actually has a little bit more credit requirements. Like it might be just maybe
yeah.
six more credits, if anything, but still.
Yeah, I'm kind of realizing that across the board, like during like school and then like post graduation, that like LMFT just in general seems to have more like requirements for
Yep, it
like
does.
everything, like with the
Oh.
board and licensing and all that.
Oh yeah, because like a lot of my classmates would be LMFTs, and we take similar classes, and they would just tell me about like their internship requirements and the certain phases they have to go through just to again like graduate and get licensed. It's like intense.
It's a lot.
Because it's not just group therapy, it's not just one-on-one therapy. It's like you need a certain amount of couples experience and family experience as well.
Relational, yeah. We have relational hours that we need.
Okay. Yeah, because me personally, I had co-occurring, so I did my like 880 in addiction counseling, but I just combined that with co-occurring. So individuals like me could go to like say an internship and that has mental health and addiction that just counts as both.
Oh, okay. That's really nice. Like, I don't know. I think like anything that's with like two or more people would count as relational. But like if I saw like a child, for example, or like an individual adult, that would not count as relational hours for my requirements for licensure. So okay. I would actually have to have a certain amount of like relational hours in order to get my license.
Which is interesting because I'm just assuming like when you work with a 5-year-old or 7-year-old, you're also kind of working with the parents in a different capacity, right, of course, but they're part of the package.
Right. And like in some cases, you know, sometimes you can do like counseling with the mom and dad and have it be like a family counseling without the client present.
Yep.
And then therefore it kind of does count as relational, but the emphasis is still on the child, with individual child.
Now, once you're licensed, can you actually bill for someone like that too, though?
Oh, absolutely. There's actually
a couples therapy, whatever, and the child is one-on-one, well, right?
I mean, it can be like couples or family therapy without client present. So, okay. For example, let's say you're doing family therapy and the identified patient is the child, but the mom and dad want to just have a session just with you. You can still bill for family therapy, but it would be like without client present, which the child is not there.
Okay.
It can get really complicated.
But billing, you know what? You know what though? I give you and all the students in LMT and all the professor, like all the credit in the world. My God, will you like have to do as a marriage and family therapist? Like I did my my first like year I went to Crown College and they called it residency, which is pretty much you're just testing out your skills at the end of the first year, and we did a little bit of couples therapy. My God, that was so hard. And there were fellows acting, but that was so hard. Oh my God, it's like, wow, I don't want this monster. This is a whole different monster.
Yeah. I actually prefer to do couples and family counseling. Yeah, I actually enjoy that. I enjoy individual counseling, but like working with couples and families, the dynamic is so interesting for me that I think it's extremely like interesting, and I prefer that actually.
Yeah. Well, I think my biggest problems when I first tried it is, you know, when there's a couple fighting in the middle of the session, I don't think I did a good enough job of like stopping the husband from talking. Hey, let Melissa talk. And then when she's done talking, you talk. Again, I'm sure there's other like techniques too, but that's where I kind of struggled with.
Yeah. Like, I think like when I work with couples and like they're starting to bicker or something in the session, I usually let them just go at it. You know, I observe. Yeah. I let them fight. Well, to an extent, if it gets like really bad, then I'll stop them. But if they're just bickering or something, I'll observe them as they do that. Because when you watch people fight, like different patterns of their communication come out, but otherwise when they're calm is a different style of communication that they display. So I actually sit there and learn while they're like learn from observing the couples while they're arguing.
Okay.
Cause I can see a different side of them that may not otherwise be seen.
And then do you make them aware of that when they are done bickering or talking? Like, hey, you know, I noticed this and that and so forth.
Yeah. Like usually I might say like, oh, it sounds like, you know, Sally here was saying this, you know, and like, Joe, you might have responded this way, but it seemed like she didn't like it how you said that. Could you say it in some other way? You know, you know, from whatever I gain from observing them, I might then utilize or actually have a better idea of how to figure out how to help them communicate better.
Yeah. And now that I think about it, it makes sense that you do that, because if you are trying to control them, yes, it's polite if one person's talking and the other person is like listening, but that's not realistic and that's not their natural like communication. Where if you do what you said, that's their natural flow of what is going on in their like negative lifestyle right now. Mm-hmm. So for you to like actually see the truth, you need to let the truth out in them.
Yeah, exactly. And I think also like people present themselves in like many different ways when they're in front of a therapist, mm-hmm. and or anyone mm-hmm. anyone that's not within the immediate relationship. And so it's always interesting to kind of like always be watching how they're presenting themselves to me, because that gives me an idea of how like their expectations about many things, like what maybe they're doing something differently in front of their partner, in front of the therapist, that, you know, that makes me, it will bring up topics of conversation that we can dig deeper into and be like, oh, well, because I'm here, like, why are you being this way differently with your husband, you know, or just what have you know? So, I mean, I feel like every opportunity in therapy that exists can be observed. And that's a learning moment. That's a moment when you can really like take that piece of information that you observe, and then you can either use it later or you can use it in the moment as a way to deeper understand the couple or the client, or as a way for to help the client better help themselves.
Okay.
So, sorry, no, I was long-winded.
No, I love this actually, because I'm thinking back again to my residency when we're doing these scenarios where I don't know if my teacher threw me a really crazy curveball that I didn't think was fair, but again, in this scenario, this woman, her husband, I think, cheated on her or whatever. So now I'm doing one-on-one therapy with the wife, mm-hmm. but the scenario was, again, the affair, and then you need to work with the wife one-on-one. But I'm thinking like, well, I'm not the family therapist, so would a family therapist be okay with one of the couples seeing another therapist one-on-one and not them one-on-one? Is that common?
I think like, you know, obviously you need to make sure everyone has releases signed and everything, and everyone's communicating with each other. Like you would be communicating with a family therapist, but yeah, obviously the releases would be signed and all that. And I think like in a situation where you start to, in the first session, you see both husband and wife or partner, both partners at the same time. I think it's okay if you're having like the initial session with two of them together, and then you break off and then just see one person individually from then on.
Okay.
But I think it gets really dicey when you kind of trade off between like both partners, you know, or it's sort of like you kind of make up your mind real soon, you know, who you're going to see and for how long, because if you're seeing the couple, you know, for a couple of sessions, and then all of a sudden maybe the wife says, well, I want to see you individually. Like, I actually think that's a little dicey, because then there's unevenness in the relationship. There can be built alliances or like, you know, the husband might feel like, oh, well, the therapist trusts my wife more than me. And then you get run into problems with trust between clients and stuff.
But then couldn't you go to the husband and be like, well, I'll see you as well at the same amount of times. So
that's interesting. So if you have your initial session with the couple, both people at the same time, and then in that first session you agree to meet with both individual clients equally, you know, like once a week each person, ongoing, as well as couples therapy. I mean, it's a lot of work for you, but I mean, I think it could work. But again, at the same time, there's always risks. So it's best to just kind of choose one type of therapy. So either see them as a couple or see one person or the identified patient as an individual, and then don't see the other person, and then have refer the other guy out to a different individual therapist.
So it is common. Okay. It's not.
Yeah. It's there's risk. And I generally, me personally, I try to be low risk. I try to be as low risk as possible. So like if I have a couple comes to me and they say, oh, we want couples therapy, but my wife just wants to see you individually, I'll probably just say, I can't see her individually, or I can't do the couple, but I can just see her individually. You know what I mean?
So you would suggest they both maybe see their own therapist individually.
If they feel they want that. Yeah.
Okay. But Now, yeah. Going back to my scenario, okay, that's cool that I know this. But then there was also another dicey thing where it's like, but you're not allowed to talk to her about family therapy because she has a family therapist. And I'm like, well, I have to talk about the affair. I feel like that's going to come up, though.
This is where
I'm not crazy.
Yeah, like, trying to avoid these situations. Yeah, I think in a situation like what you're in, I think it's best to first of all, get a release and talk to the family therapist. Yep. And explain the situation and just say, look, you know, I'm just seeing the couple, and you know, you're obviously doing family therapy, and may I please communicate with you just for, you know, coordination of services. But other than that, like, I don't think it's necessary, or it's not necessary. If it's not necessary, I'm not going to communicate with you about what goes on in the couples therapy with the family therapist, because that's almost even borderline like a HIPAA, like, yeah, ethical, questionable area. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you just want to make sure you keep it really clean and clear between you and the other therapist.
Yeah.
I think if there's things that are going on that affect the couple and the family directly, and you're like, oh, this is definitely a issue that needs to be addressed by the family therapist, sure, go ahead, talk to the family therapist, no problem. But mm-hmm. I don't think there should be like an open door, you know, between couples therapist and family therapist, just because, you know, it just doesn't seem like it's a little overkill, and it doesn't seem like it's necessary. Ethically, it might not be the best.
Yeah,
but I mean, again, this is just my opinion, so yeah, I would consult with your supervisor.
for sure. So again, going back to the grad school experience, obviously there's probably ups and downs for a lot of people, but if you can go back and maybe add something to it, like a class, like, what do you think grad school is like missing that would be really beneficial for the future therapists in the world?
I definitely would say that if we could get a very specific class on billing and insurance and like documentation. Preach. I know there's some on documentation, but oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, preach. Keep going. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, if we could get like a very specific elective on or two different electives. One of them is on billing and billing insurance and, you know, all that stuff. Second elective is on how to write a diagnostic assessment, and maybe also an individual treatment plan, and also how to incorporate assessments for families and children, like a CASI or like a SDQ or things like that, and how to incorporate those assessments into a diagnostic assessment, like how to incorporate.
What's the CASI again? Because sounds familiar to like some of the stuff I did in ARMS a little bit.
CASI is for children age 6 and up, and I think there might even be a CASI called eCASI for children younger than age 6. Okay. Or no, I might have had that backwards. Okay, anyway. Basically what it is just like a set of questions, different domains that cover topics such as like risk of harm.
Okay.
It's kind of like a functional assessment, but it's not so in-depth as a functional assessment. Like, it just only has specific areas. And there's like a rating scale of like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And it's kind of based on level of severity or level of or kind of, you know, different things like that. And you add up the numbers and then you tally it. It gives you a number.
Yep.
And then there's like different levels, and like the level, wherever you're like your own practice or your institution where you work or whatever, they may have a specific level, which a level of care at which they work. So like, for example, level 2 is just like most common. So like when you're assessing your client, you might find that your client is like at a level like 1. So they're like, oh, well, you're actually like pretty high functioning for our level of care, because we're at level 2. So then you can further kind of discern and figure out what would be a better placement for them, or like what can we do to like accommodate or like meet the needs of the client who are at differing levels other than the level that you're chosen to be at. So
beautiful.
That makes any sense.
No, I 110% agree to you. So I could be like, through all the knowledge that you just expressed right now, that'd probably be a good solid 2-3 credit class, though, to be honest. Like,
Well, I mean, I know they do have assessment classes at, like, at St. Mary's. Yeah. They have a whole class of all these assessments. So, but specifically, like, the elective that I would hope that they could create would be, like, specifically a DA, like a diagnostic assessment. Mm-hmm. First of all, how to write a good one. Like, that's, like, write one that's, like, approved by insurance companies. And then how to best incorporate those other assessments into the diagnostic assessment so that you can utilize those other assessments in your diagnostic assessment, how best to do that. So that's beautiful. Kind of what I would
do. And it's funny, cause that's what, like, my LPCC supervisor is, like, trying to teach me now.
Oh, yeah.
He really wants me to work on assessments. Cause let's just say 3 to 4 months ago, she was just like, looked at me and she's like, Jake, you got to work on your assessments. I mean, respectfully, you know, she cared about me, yeah, but she was totally showing me tough love.
Yeah.
And this might get into later questions I might want to ask you, but she's just looking at me. She's like, which is weird because when I was an intern, I probably would have done a lot better job. But when you're working in certain areas, you're not, like, so much focused on mental health assessments. Right. Where, again, I'm co-occurring. And right out of the gate of grad school, yeah, I have my mental health degree, but I'm just not saying just as it's little, but I'm an LADC. Yeah. You don't spend any time doing mental health assessments. It's a just different animal.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But she's looking at me. She's just, Jake, like, she's like, give me major depression. Go, give me the symptoms. And I might have given her, like, 3. And respectfully, with care, she's just like, Jake, you're not at a good place right now in assessments. I don't feel comfortable signing off on your LPCC from where your level's at right now. She's like, no disrespect, but you can't diagnose depression and you're almost halfway done. And I don't feel, like, good about signing off on your LPCC from where you're at.
Yeah.
Tough love.
Yeah. In a situation like that, like, what I would do is I would recommend getting a physical copy of the DSM-5 TR.
I do. Yep.
Oh, okay.
I've gotten much better since then, and she's very happy for my improvement. Yeah. But no, you're right. I mean,
like, just kind of read it like a dictionary. Just, like, go down, and I think there's somewhere. I bet there's somewhere where you can get, like, flashcards for, like.
Well, Amazon has this really good, like, little tap thing where they have all the disorders, and you could put them in your DSM. So you know where each disorder is, like, page 352.
Wow, yeah. That's intense.
Which I should have done, but instead I just been using sticky notes and I've been writing the disorder and putting it in, like, the pages. So it's the same thing, but it looks a lot more sloppier, but it, you know.
Hey, it works.
Mm-hmm. But no, like when she was going over assessments with me, again, she's trying to encourage me, and maybe you have some similar stories too, but with your supervisor, but she's like, okay, like, an insurance company wouldn't take this diagnostic and this is why. Because mm-hmm. A, B, and C, you didn't explain this right, and so forth.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah, I would say, like, for me, I was very fortunate to have an outstanding professor at St. Mary's for abnormal psychology or psychopathology course. Yep. And it was a very intensive course. And I just paid super close attention and took really insane notes and tore up the DSM and got a fairly good grade because I worked very hard in that class. Yeah. And the work that I did stuck in it, really got burned in my brain. And then when I went out and worked in the field for, you know, as an arms worker, and then as what else did I do? I worked in day treatment for a long time. I worked in ERTS, you know, all these different types of settings where I saw many different types of diagnoses and just worked with those people. I think just, like, the combination between the book work and then, like, the real life hands-on, like, literally working with those folks, like, made it more, like, 3D for me. And then, and then I was able to just, like, when it came time to write the assessment, I, like, really understood. And so I would, of course, refer to the DSM, just double check, but it was almost like I was just kind of, like, rereading, you know. And then, and then, of course, the more you do it, the better you get. So it feeds upon itself. And then I'm at a point now where, like, with my own practice and everything, I just, of course, I consult the DSM, but I feel like I can just spot it. I can just spot it in people. Like, if I have a new client and they have, like, major depression, for example, they don't have to say anything. I can just watch their their behavior and I can really spot it.
And just hearing their stories too.
Yeah. Hearing their stories, just even how they talk. And I know that sounds just so deductive. I'm not trying to deduct people down to a diagnosis or anything like that, but mm-hmm. it's just kind of like any kind of skill you learn really well, you just start intuitively like picking up on things because you're so used to seeing things over and over again.
And I'm slowly kind of getting there. It's getting a lot better for me. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of cool, but when I hear your story, like you really worked hard. It seems like you actually did put in a lot of effort.
I did.
And I commend you for that. That's awesome though. You earned it though.
Well, I feel like I feel like that was like the most important part of my education, actually.
Yeah.
I felt like at the time that if I don't get this class down, you know, if I don't really learn this, I'm not going to be able to succeed in my career. Yeah. And so I took it extremely seriously, and I'm so glad I did because it really stuck in my brain after that class. Like I remembered a lot, and I feel fortunate that my brain was able to be open to that at that time.
No, that's amazing. It's kind of like you get a lot of scenarios too where I'm sad to say, like when I took the DSM abnormal psych class, I did get an A. And again, you never really want to harp on the teacher. It's just sometimes certain teachers' styles or professor styles don't really resonate with you.
Sure.
I'll say he was a nice guy. He wasn't disrespectful. It was just really hard for me to learn. But for some reason, I ended up with an A, but I really sadly didn't feel like I learned that much about the DSM. I really didn't, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that actually, I've heard other clinicians have that problem because it's such a, it's like learning a new language, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the diagnoses and things like that. And I think that like, if someone's not like, if their brain, I can't even describe it. Like just some people maybe have like sort of like a knack for that, I guess. I have no idea. Honestly, I have no idea. But for it, you know how like some people can catch on, they can go to a foreign country and then just like learn language without reading a book. Yep. And then other people, like they have to study and study and study and they might be okay, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I really don't understand why it's just that some people are able to, you know, diagnose pretty easily or, you know, just have a knack for it.
Well, and again, I'll just be vulnerable and keep it honest with you. Again, after I graduated, I simply just didn't put in like the work to learn about the DSM and regarding my DSM class. Now that I'm thinking back, I think it was more, again, going back to like the paper and essay thing where he would say, hey, like pick a diagnosis, whatever, and write a paper on it. And at the end of the paper, like what are the pros and cons of this DA and what are some interventions and so forth. Well, you learn about that disorder and then you just move on to the next assignment. But it never, for me anyways, it never just stuck in my head because you just move on to the next thing. And you're doing a paper and you're getting like a 95% on the paper and you move on to the next. So I personally wasn't retaining anything, but I was doing well in the class.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It could also be like a learning style thing, you know, like maybe that teacher just wasn't fitting your learning style.
Mm-hmm. It's a little way off topic, but I don't know if you've ever seen that show Silicon Valley.
No, I haven't actually.
It's a comedy on HBO and he sounded like just like one of the characters. So it was kind of, I mean, that was a kind of like a cool enjoyment in class. I'll say that. But.
Yeah. Well, I think that like my professor for my psychopathology class, like she was really funny and like really laid back. Okay. But at the same time, she was like super smart and like really like creative and like interesting. And like everyone in the class just loved her. And we had a great vibe going in the class. Like it was like fun going to class, you know?
Yep.
So I had like a really positive experience. I looked forward to that class. It was just so fun and interesting.
What was her name? Like, should we give her a shout out?
Oh, I don't remember her name. Oh. She's not there anymore, but she works at the VA, yes.
Oh, sweet.
But I can't remember her name. Oh, gosh, because it was a long, I went there to school a long time ago.
Yeah.
But she just made it so interesting. And so like, and then we'd have discussions about it. So the discussions, I'm definitely a discussion person. Yes. The discussions about the diagnoses helps you like conceptualize what they were like, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we had like a definition, we had like, you know, drilling of the textbook, and then we had the discussion. So multi different ways of learning. And I think that kind of covered all the bases for me personally. Okay. So I was able to like absorb it all and really retain it. So she's like by far the best, one of the best professors I've ever had. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, and again, with the DAs and the billing codes, I think it's so important. And that actually goes with my answer to my own question regarding, okay, if you could pick one class, I would pick for grad schools to add like maybe a nice little one credit, two credit. Hey, I want to own my private practice class. If you ever want to own your private practice, what are the steps in doing that? Do you need to get licensed or do you need a certain license to be able to, again, do that?
Yeah, totally. I actually was very fortunate enough to take one of those classes at St. Mary's. Yeah, I don't remember who, again, I don't remember who taught it, but it was basically, the class was like an intro to starting your own private practice.
That's so cool.
So yeah, it was really amazing. So I took that, it was just like a two credit. I took it and just learned really basics about just how to get going, you know, how to start it up and what to watch for and liability insurance and all that stuff.
Yes.
And so yeah. And actually the funny thing is, I don't know if you're aware, but in 2020, so in January of 2020, I actually did start my practice.
Yeah, what's it called again?
It's called Hayreen Counseling. So it's actually my middle name. Nice. So it's Hayreen Counseling, yeah. And it right now it's a little dormant. I have to renew the LLC. But once I get that up and rolling again, I can start seeing clients again.
Okay. So I actually have my own LLC again for my podcast, and that can go with businesses too. I thought once you pay for it for life. Is that true or how's that work?
Well, I'm not sure because I thought that my LLC has to be renewed every year.
Okay.
So I actually didn't renew it last year. So I don't know if I lost it, but I'm going to just contact the Secretary of State and find out kind of what's going on.
Yeah, because I think there's this website where you can like type in the name you want your facility to be and they'll let you know if it's taken or not taken.
I think that's like part of the process of getting an LLC. Yeah. But then like once you actually get the LLC, you have to like pay $150 or something and then like you have it. And then I think you have to like renew that every year by paying $150 every year to like renew your LLC. Excuse me, but I could be wrong. So I should probably just contact the Secretary of State and ask them, you know, like if it's good to go for a lifetime or not.
Okay. Well, I know liability and professional liability insurance, you do have to renew that every year, right?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Which, that's more expensive. That's the big one.
Yeah.
No, that is so cool. And also, and this is something I'm kind of working on now too. Did you know that LADCs can own their own private practices now?
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
It was a rule or a law that was made like 2 or 3 years ago, but like when I heard about it, I didn't put too much stock into it because I'm thinking in my head like, oh, so I'm just going to do like groups in my basement or whatever. Or how does that work? But actually, I ran into a guy on Facebook who's actually doing that. And he is actually a guest on my podcast, but he explained kind of on Facebook as LADCs, how do you actually start that? And I thought that was really cool. But to be aware to all the LADCs listening out there, you can't do that right after you graduate. So you need to be an LADC for 6,000 hours post, which is equivalent to 3 years.
Okay.
But now for us in the mental health field, isn't it 4 years to do a private practice or just to get licensed?
I actually don't know. But or
2 years. I'm sorry. 2 years, I think it is.
Oh, 2 years. Actually, I'm not sure. But I started my practice and then I consulted with had a supervisor that I was seeing and I asked them, like, I'm like, is this okay if I do this? I'm not licensed yet. You know, I'm just LA MFT. And they were like, hey, as long as you are getting supervision and you're working towards your licensure, no problem.
So you can, as a mental health student, like you just graduated from your master's degree, right? You can own your own company if you have a supervisor. Is that correct?
I think if you're, let's see here. I don't know. I would have to call the board just to find out for sure. I mean, for LMFT, I have to find out for sure. But I think you might have to have like your associates, like your LAMFT.
And for us, I think you might. LPC. Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure though. So I think you might have to have at least some kind of like license like even if it's like a provisional license, or I mean like an associate, because if you just have like a master's, I don't know. But I know that you do have to have supervision though, for sure. Yeah.
And well, another bad thing though, it's good to get like, so your LAMFT is similar to like our LPC, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But can you really do that much insurance wise compared to,
oh, I do not do insurance at all. I can't.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that could be an argument. It's like, what's the difference? Yeah, you have more supervision, but again, you can't do anything like, let's say, like an LMFT can, right?
Yeah. Like if I was an LMFT, I could, and I was credentialed, I could just run it like as if I worked for like a group practice or something. Of course, that would be really annoying because I'd have to do my own billing and do all this other legwork, which is a lot of work.
Yes.
So that's why it's like a little nicer to like work for an agency that does like a group practice that has like their own billing company that they work out of, mm-hmm. so that you don't have to have the hassle of having to do the billing and stuff. But as far as, so when I did my own prior practice, I was just a private pay. Like I was a cash practice.
How'd that go?
So I
just
charged cash. It was scary at first because I was really, really, really afraid to ask people for money in the beginning. I started the prior practice in January of 2020, and I didn't get my first paying client until September of 2020. It took me nine months to get the nerve up to ask people for money.
Like on your website, or do you have like a standard rate you charge per session type thing?
No,
it's okay.
No, it's okay. But yeah, like in the beginning when I started my practice, I was like afraid to even list a price because I thought that people wouldn't pay because I'm not licensed. So I just did everything pro bono.
So I
had tons of clients, but not getting paid.
And then how do you ask them for money? Like, hey, so I've been doing this for a while. Can I get a 50?
Well, 9 months later. So basically what ended up happening was the people that were doing getting the pro bono service, I would ask them if they like knew anyone else that could give me a referral of anyone else that was looking for therapy. Okay. So like, oh yeah, I have a friend. So then the friend would come and contact me. And then I would say, okay, so I have an introductory, you know, one or two session that's pro bono, but then after the second session, it's going to be and then my regular rates. And then but because they had the recommendation from their friends, they weren't just coming into it blindly. They had an idea that they liked me and that I had a reputation with their friend. So then they were more likely to pay the money as opposed to just ending after the second session.
Okay.
So it's kind of like a fish hook way of getting.
Yeah, because I'm sure you had some worry in your head. Like, did you ever think like, well, what if the one friend goes to the other friend? Like, wait, but you don't pay it all, so now I gotta pay.
Right. So there's always that concern, but luckily nothing ever came up. So no one ever confronted me about it. And I think, what I told the initial person was saying, so because, you know, your services are free, you know, it's because I was still in training with this company. And so because I was not fully, you know, like, seasoned yet.
Okay.
That's why you've got a free service. But you know, it's been 9 months and I've had my feet on the ground and I'm ready to start charging people. And then after that initial little bumpy period of then after I had new clients coming in, I charged my full rate and sometimes I would make like a good chunk of money in one day. Like sometimes I make a really nice amount. Yeah.
Okay, because again, like, good thing about insurance is, like, I'm assuming you get more clients, but again, they take a certain percentage out.
Yes. Yes, they do. But with cash pay, you get 100%. Of course, you have to factor in, like, you know, taxes and all that, so. Mm-hmm. But you have to do that with insurance, too, so.
So I want to ask you a really cool question. In this scenario, I want you to go in your DeLorean or go back in time. What would you tell yourself 2 years ago, you're just starting your private practice. Would you do anything different knowing what you know now?
Yeah, I would.
Would you actually make them pay a little bit?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Or just anything in general.
Yeah, I would I would probably start off with what I had developed after a while, which is where it's like that introductory rate. You know, like the first session is free. and then it's going to be my regular rate. Okay. I probably would have just started with that.
That's cool. I like that.
And then I wouldn't have to have such a steep, you know, like getting into like steep, like put myself in such a steep angle of trying to get paid. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have to be such a huge gap between no money and money. Mm-hmm. So, but
okay,
it was definitely very nice to do family DAs.
Okay.
Or family intakes, because that was my highest rate. And I mean, I don't know if I'm allowed to say, but I charged $250 an hour for that.
Nice. No, and don't be ashamed.
Yeah. And I had people pay me, like write me a check for $250, and I do sometimes two in a day.
So you could tell your past 2 years ago, they will pay you. They will pay you. You deserve this.
Yes. It took me like over a year to get to the point of where I'd believe that someone would write me a check for $250 to do a family intake.
Mm-hmm.
It took a long time for me to actually believe that that would actually happen, because I was worried that someone would laugh in my face and walk away. But no, people will pay.
Did you just not trust your clinical skills right after graduating, or what was the issue? You think confidence, or
I think it was confidence. I also think it was just feeling like there's something called imposter syndrome. Have you ever heard of that?
Yep.
Like I was really struggling with that. I thought, who the heck am I? I'm nobody. Mm. Like I'm not a therapist, you know, like I'm not enabled, you know, and I didn't really believe in myself. And so because I didn't quite believe myself, other people were a little like, are you legit? You know what I mean? Like that. Yeah. But then after a while I started working with more clients and getting more developed in my practice. And I started believing in myself more, and my supervisor's helping me. And I was getting better with documentation, just getting much better with diagnosing and stuff. And that's when I just started, my confidence went up, and then I started asking for a little bit more money because I raised my rates a little bit, and I got the money that I asked for. And then as soon as that started happening regularly, I was like, oh man, that, like this is really possible. Yep. So yeah, it is possible.
Oh, and here's another thing too, like for all the listeners listening, let's say, you know, they start their practice and they're struggling, they're having a hard time. What bit of advice would you give them to help overcome the hard times?
When you have a person that's calling you about seeking therapy or counseling or whatever, I would just approach it from like a really hands-off approach, in the sense, not that you don't want them as a client, but just don't cling at them in any way, and give them like freedom to just choose whatever they want. Mm-hmm. So I just always leave it as really open with clients. So if a client calls me and they're like, hey, Rebecca, I have a daughter and I was wondering if I'd come in for family therapy. I'd be like, sure. Like, would you be interested in scheduling an intake at some point? You know, I leave it really open, and I leave it up to the client's control and their own control, their own power to direct how beginning stages of therapy go, because I want them to feel like they have the freedom and the control to choose what they want. If I'm in there and I'm saying, all right, sure, I can see your daughter, how about this Thursday at 3 p.m., you know, then the mom might be like, oh, I don't know about that, can I call you back? And then I'll never hear from them again.
Yeah.
So I just really like to let the client realize that they have a choice, and it's up to them. It is their, it's voluntary. Mm-hmm. It's up to them to decide if they want services. And I'll be there for them, but I'm not going to like push in any way.
That's good.
That's how I do it.
And it works for you.
Yeah. I had a pretty nice practice going for a period of time. I chose to stop the practice because during the slow months, which is for therapy, which is usually about June to end of August.
Yep.
I had to just take up another job because I just, everyone's on vacation. Everyone's, you know, kids are at summer camp. Okay. So.
And so how does that work? Do you just like put on the website your clothes, or do you just like pause billing services, or?
Well, usually that's when I pick up a part-time job, or I use that time if I have enough saved. It depends on how much money I've saved. Mm-hmm. If I have enough money saved, then I spend that time in development. Like, how do I, you know, redo this paper, this documentation to be better? You know, how do I make the intake more effective? How do I brush up on my marketing? You know, how do I like look for pull out for different clientele or more clientele. Yeah. You know, I really do all my research during that time. It's kind of like my sabbatical time, so to speak.
Okay, that's actually cool. Now, that leads me to my next one. Would you ever recommend hiring like a business manager or a marketing guru person to help you with your business? Or is it a waste of money?
I guess it depends on my budget. So if I'm doing really well with my practice, I want to reach a larger audience, but I don't quite know how. Mm-hmm. I might hire a consultant, you know, try to get some help with that area.
Okay.
It just depends on how much I want to expand. And then, of course, if I expand, I might need help. I might have to hire a therapist.
Yep.
And then I got to look into that and all that. So.
Okay.
But I haven't gotten there.
And this is also an interesting point. If you choose not to take insurance, does that mean you don't really need to give a DA?
You know, that's interesting. Technically, no, I don't have to do a DA because I'm not diagnosing. And because, but if I did a DA, it would be only for my own personal, like, way to better understand the client, to just assist, you know, treat them better, right? Because if I know what they're, if I actually am able to get an idea of what their diagnosis is, then I can have a better, more accurate treatment plan for them. And then obviously maybe their outcome will be better. So ethically, it's best to have a DA. I think whether or not you take insurance or not, it's best to have a DA. But technically, I don't have to because I'm not using insurance.
Oh, I know a lot of therapists that don't do DAs because, well, there's like the whole labeling thing. And they find it better just to go free throw or not free, like just go with the flow, which there seems to be no structure in that mindset where I like yours, where it's good to have a DA to, again, know where your client's at, know where the goals are.
I actually think it's ethical to have a DA. I know that sounds a little odd because there's some folks out there that are like, oh my God, it's so unethical to put people in a box, you know? But I think it depends on how you view that box, right?
Yes.
So if you're viewing that box to oppress people and label them and then, like, you know, decimate them down to like a code, obviously that's not ethical. That's not good to do to people. But if you're using a DA to better understand someone and to like what I had just said, like how you can like provide treatment that's more accurate and like appropriate for that person. You know, you might have a client that comes in who's like just screaming borderline, you know, right? They are just like to the T borderline personality disorder. And you don't do a DA and you're not really thinking about it. You might think that they might benefit from, you know, like something that would be better for someone with OCD or something, you know, I mean, or whatever, you know, like you may be giving them the wrong treatment without realizing it. Yep. So I think it's just ethical to try to be as accurate as possible and to help your person as much as you can.
Well, so that's just me. I even had one of my professors say that he's a director and he'd have his like therapist like give a wrong diagnosis. So they'll send the diagnosis into the insurance company. But let's say they do like a certain therapy that doesn't really go along with that diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, again, I don't know how true this is, the insurance company will not bill because they're like, well, you're doing CBT and this person has this kind of issue.
Yeah.
Like, what's going on here? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that happens because I know when you're writing a DA, part of the DA is that your job is to sort of like write a case for support of your diagnosis. So let's say you're diagnosing someone with adjustment disorder, but they really have like ADHD or something, you know, and you're like using all these like adjustment disorder, like treatments for someone, or excuse me, you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
You know, the insurance companies can reject your DA. They can say no. Like, how does this prove to me that this person has adjustment disorder? You know, like you have to like literally prove a little mini case each time you're writing a DA, and that's the point of the DA. Mm-hmm. To like, you know, verify someone's mental state mental illness, right? The verify it
for so again, like you can't just say, well, I'm doing CBT, like that doesn't always fly.
Well, it's not like a one size fits all therapy, right? I mean,
exactly.
I mean, I'm trying to think of like a diagnosis that would not do well CBT. What about like schizoid personality disorder? You know, someone who's very like absent. Like, are they really going to respond? Maybe. But I mean, there might be a different modality that might be better. Like something, I think something personally, this is just my personal opinion, something that's more experiential would be appropriate for that person, because you want to get them in touch with their feelings and their expression, because they're void of expression and they're void of feelings. So, I mean, telling them to think about their voidness of feeling, I'm not sure if a cognitive intellectual approach is going to be most helpful. I think getting them in their body, getting them somatic, a somatic therapy might be more helpful for them. But that's just that's my interpretation.
That's beautiful. And let me throw something else at you. EMDR, like, and again, that is like the biggest fad going on right now. even therapists will even be like, EMDR. I'm like, okay, EMDR is not always the right answer. If they're, again, not in tune with their body or not familiar with any type of dialectical behavior therapy, mindfulness to be in tunement with themselves, they're not going to do well with EMDR therapy. It may make it worse.
Exactly. Think of a person who has complex PTSD.
They hear trauma. Like, EMDR. Trauma. Oh, EMDR. It's like, no.
Well, I mean, but the thing is that, like, let's say that there's a person who, okay, so let's say there's a person who has dissociative disorder, right? Or DID, like dissociative identity disorder, also complex PTSD, like a secondary diagnosis, and you have a therapist there who's like, oh, I they have trauma, I should use EMDR. Maybe. But what if the EMDR is so intense for them and triggers so much stuff that they just disassociate? Well, the whole point is to get them in their body. And also to learn how to not disassociate, right? Tolerate distress.
Right.
And another thing, I would actually use DBT with that client, honestly. Instead of EMDR, I would use DBT. So that's just what I would do. But, you know, everyone, there's, I actually strongly believe that there is no hard right or wrong, you know? I think that the whole entire field of psychology and therapy is subjective. I mean, the only thing objective, closest thing to objective would be a diagnosis. But I think that, like, when it comes to, you know, theories and methods and ways, approaches, ways of going about treating this or that, I think it is kind of up to the therapist and client, you know, their relationship, how they relate, you know, how they work together with what, you know, all that. I think there are some therapies that work better for other diagnoses than not. But I think what it boils down to is what is in the best interest of the client. Not what is the favorite method for the therapist.
I love that, because I use that example when I'm even in a group, and when clients want to be like, well, 12 steps is the only way, this or that. And I'm like, well, no, it's not. And you have no right to like tell someone else what's best for them. And again, love using the muscle guy personal training example, where you see some buff dude who's a personal trainer and he's Mr. Olympia. Okay, great. He knows what works for him. Does that mean he's going to be a great personal trainer and take Sally and just look at Sally's body or form, be like, okay, this is the perfect treatment plan for like fitness. This is your fitness plan.
Right.
Like, okay, physiologically and biomechanically, whatever, that could be the best, but it's still not the best thing for that client.
Right, exactly. It's because not everyone's the same.
Yes.
I think it just boils down to that basic truth that not everyone is the same. There's no one human being. Everyone's very different. And we all need different things.
And I know what you said about, like, you know, different therapists have different styles and it's subjective. EMDR is the only one where I am the most afraid of, though, when it comes to that, because I feel like that can actually do the most psychological damage to someone if they're not the right fit for it. And if the right therapist is not doing it for the client, or for the client who is not the right fit for it. That I feel like can get into legal issues. You could be easily sued, especially if you're not EMDR certified. Even though.
Is it because it's. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, go on.
Is it because EMDR affects the neurology of someone?
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, what else am I trying to say? Again, maybe I'm told different things. Obviously, you shouldn't do a technique if you're like not certified in it per se. But again, I heard like some therapists do it when they just graduate grad school. So they have their master's degree, so they do EMDR. Could they get away with that? Well, they're not going to get billed for it because I know it's a different billing service. But the fact that they could try that and get away with it is kind of scary, to my opinion.
Yeah, that's scary. Definitely. I think that there's other ways to repattern the brain. Have you ever heard of brain gym?
I know brain spotting, but brain...
No, it's not the same.
Okay.
Yeah. Brain gym is actually like a kinesiology.
Okay. My undergrad's in exercise science, so...
Okay. Yeah. And it's actually like a set of specific physical exercises that a person can do. And it's not like an eye movement thing. It's like a physical, like arm, leg, you know, body movement. And well, it's very specific, but there's all these different exercises. And what it actually does is it turns on both sides of the brain, the right and left brain.
Okay.
It turns on both sides of the brain. So that person's using their whole brain when learning something or dealing with a tough situation. And it actually strengthens the midsection. I think it's the corpus calloseum. Is it like the midsection of the brain? It strengthens that so that the communication between the right and left sides of the brain are more like efficient, and they like work better together in tandem. Okay. So brain gym used to be a big deal back in like the 90s, I think, the 80s and the 90s, but now it's not really known very much. And I've only been able to see one booklet of all the exercises, and I think it's out of print now. So in my therapy, when I work with clients, I use some brain gym exercises, the ones I know. Okay. And I don't know too many, but I know enough that I can help someone with a learning disability or like, cause I work with kids, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, and it just seems like it really works for some people, you know, they really connect with it. So that's my sort of use. If I want to use EMDR, I use something like that, because that is like a somatic like a somatic type of repatterning of the brain. And I just find that to be maybe pretty effective too. So
like when you work with kids, do most of them have more of a hyperactive disorder like ADD, ADHD, and helps calm them down in a lot of scenarios? Or
yeah, definitely. Yeah. Because like the hyperactivity is a result of one or both sides of the brain is just kind of like not really functioning very well.
Mm-hmm. When isn't it a lack of activity too, through the prefrontal cortex, decision making as well, and so forth?
Oh yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, I mean, like in our response, in the response to the EMDR conversation, I was just saying that like I think that like as an alternative, like something that's safer, I guess. I mean, not safer, but something less risky. Yes. I would use something like brain gym, because it's just, it's literally just like repatterning, like activating the right and left sides of the brain.
Or have you ever heard of like EFT tapping?
I have. Okay. Yeah, I have actually. And as an alternative to EFT tapping, I do Qigong with my clients.
Oh, nice.
So there's a tapping exercise in Qigong that is really gentle and it's very grounding. So when I have children that are just going crazy, you know, off the wall or whatever, I have them do Qigong and they just like get really calm.
Now that's similar to Tai Chi, am I right?
Kind of, yeah.
Because I do that with my clients too.
Yeah. Traditional Chinese medicine.
I love it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Although I'm not a practitioner of that. So I, disclaimer.
Yeah. So again, I'm really not knocking EMDR. I want to be certified in it one day, except again, it's very expensive. It takes a long time. So someday. But also I remember again, doing my internship through grad school, I'd go to my professor. It's like, yeah, you know, someday they'll like, I want to learn like the really cool and interesting like trauma therapies, this and that, because I feel like I can't help the client. He's like, no, well, you can help the client. Yeah, it's cool to know things like EMDR and other therapies, but just teaching them like meditation, being in tune with their body is helping them so much as well.
Exactly. Sometimes even just breathing. And I know that like, it's such a cliche. Everyone says, oh, breathing, that does nothing for me. Well, I've heard that so many times from clients that breathing does nothing for them. But I think that like there's different things you can couple with the breathing. Mm-hmm. So one classic example that I use is, so I have a client take a, you know, inhale. And when they have their eyes closed and they inhale, I have them have one hand on their chest, one hand on just below the belly button. And when they're inhaling and exhaling, they're imagining the sort of air going from their belly button out their chest. And then when they, so like when they inhale the belly button, you're going in the belly button, they exhale out the chest.
Interesting.
And then they just kind of like do like a circle. And like,
okay,
for some reason, like, you know, like they imagine the air, like a, the air pathway, like a circle, like yes. Inhale in the belly button, out to the chest, inhale in the belly button, out to the chest. And I feel like when people are given like breathing exercises with a visual, like with active visualization, it actually works better to calm them down and to help change whatever state they're in.
Yes.
So anyway, that's just one little thing I do too. So there's all these little things that I do in my practice.
Well, that's cool though. So again, getting to another aspect, when you, again, work as a professional and you're a practice, you kind of promote your style of therapy, your interventions, your strengths. Again, sometimes I'll look on psychology.com for therapists, right? And look at their profile. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, but a lot of times, I think some of them are so BS where they specialize in 30 different types of therapies and so forth. And those are, again, to my audience, be somewhat wary of those therapists. Because I don't think any human being can specialize in 30 different therapies or at least be adequate in them. So asking you, going through grad school and now to your like being a professional and everything, do you again feel like grad school really prepared you for what type of style of therapist you want to be? Or was it more of finding who you are when you were done with grad school?
I see a little bit of both, actually.
Okay.
So when I was in my, when I was in grad school, one particular like method or something that I really appreciate was experiential.
Okay. Yep.
I just really, and clearly I'm very experiential, but I really appreciate like gestalt therapy and things like that.
Yep.
And wrote a paper on it and all that, you know? And so that was kind of influenced from grad school. But then when I got out into the real world, I really took a liking to DBT, dialectical behavior therapy. And so I'm not a certified DBT therapist, but I like to utilize a lot of the concepts in therapy because I feel like DBT is just so generally good for everything. And for the most part, so if I were to characterize myself, I would say I'm a, experiential DBT somatic therapist.
Okay. Nice.
So the somatic and experiential could sort of be like redundant. But I like to separate and say somatic because a lot of the work I do is like literally so much with the body. Like I said, like the brain gym exercises, like the breathing, the hands on the chest and the belly and, you know, the Qigong and stuff. Like a lot of that is like my treatment. Okay. And I find that, I'm drawn to that because I really believe that when a person, especially if they go through trauma or, you know, a lot of stress, that gets stuck in the body.
Yes. Body keeps
and so, score. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yep. And so like, it would make most sense to work on the body to help release the trauma and then work through the emotional part of it.
Yes.
But I think that you can't work through the emotional part unless it's released from the body first. That doesn't make any sense to try to like, think about it and talk about it if it's just stuck in the body first, you know?
And another thing to add is just psychoeducation, explain to the clients, you know, this is my style. This is what's going to happen in therapy, just to, again, get them ready for the experience. And again, I don't really know what your philosophy is on trauma, because I've even heard of therapists like say to the client, or the client will ask the therapist, okay, like, when are my bad memories and my trauma going to be gone forever? Because I just don't want to deal with it anymore. I don't want to think about it. Like the time I was raped or this and that, just as an example. And there's the therapist would be like, it's not ever going to be go away because it's a part of you, but you learn to manage it.
Yeah. I would say that like to say it's not ever going to be away or go away is pretty extreme. What I would say if a client asked that I would say, you know, it may take some time, but it will get better.
Okay.
If you tell someone it's not going to go away, that sounds like it's just going to stay the same. Like I can see how someone would misinterpret that.
Yep.
But if the client asked me that, I would say it might be really bad right now. Like you might be hurting really bad right now, but you know, over time and with just skills or things that we're going to work on, it will get better. And
you, okay.
Yeah. So that's just my response.
And another thing to consider is maybe if you do have that thought again down the road or experience that those thoughts with that emotion, those emotions will not be nearly as powerful as they once were.
Right. In a response like that, I usually tell the clients, like, you know, imagine that, like, right when, like, you know, just after the trauma happened,
yeah,
imagine that it was like a neon sign, right? Blinking or whatever, really yeah. big. But over time, it's going to fade to the point of where it's just a see-through sign that doesn't, you know what I mean? Or just some mm-hmm. kind of example how it just slowly fades away. And I just want to let you know that my battery is running kind of low on my phone and I don't have a charger with me. So
I'll probably
have to wrap up fairly soon, but
that is just fine.
Is there any last words you want to say?
Yeah. So again, I just want to thank you so much for being on my podcast. I really appreciate it. I do.
Yeah. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So if my listeners do want to get a hold of you, is there a particular website or number they could use to send you a message? Or?
Sure. Actually, I'm working on my website right now. It's in the process of getting up. So not yet, but I do have a work like cell phone number that I can leave with you and then you can, or I can just say it right now. It doesn't matter. Did you want me to just go ahead and.
Yeah. And I'll put it in my show notes too. So they have it.
Sure. Right, yeah. So the best way to reach me is through email and cell phone. And my email is, it's basically my name, which is REBECCA dot HR dot ERICKSON at gmail.com. And my work cell phone is 612-248-0700.
Well, excellent. Thank you. And all right. Make sure it gets in my show notes.
Sure. Thank you so much. This was really fun.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye. Bye-bye. I again want to give a special thanks to Rebecca and all of my BHI listeners for another great episode. I just want to inform everyone that the content expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a licensed medical doctor or a licensed mental health and addiction therapist. All right, everyone. Thank you. Have a good day. Bye.